Hi, hello. Welcome to another podcast by the Oxford Society for International Development. My name is Yilun. I'm your Asia Pacific Events Officer, and I'm very excited today to be bringing you one of our first podcasts of the year. Today's topic is definitely very interesting, and it's something that I think not a lot of us had first thought about when we were considering international development. But my reaction was the more that I got into it, the more insightful and relevant it became. To our subject, so much so that I was a bit wondering why I hadn't realized about its importance before. And this topic is languages. It's the language that we speak day to day, the languages that unite different countries and the continent together, and the languages that minority peoples speak to preserve their cultural identity. The reason that I chose this topic is twofold. One is that if we are to understand international development as something that, I guess, put it vaguely and very unprofessionally, something that makes us happier, then there is much more to happiness, or at least in my opinion, there's much more to happiness, apart from the economic and political facets of life. Don't get me wrong, both of these are very important. This is coming from a PPE student. Both of these are very important, but I don't think they fully capture a third facet of what makes us really happy. And that is definitely our culture and our identity. And in that, having the ability to enrich our culture alongside our economy as we develop is definitely something that should be regarded highly in the developmental policies that people pursue. And it should also be something regarded highly by the people who would live within countries and should definitely be prioritized when, you know, trade-offs are made over whether language should be preserved and protected. And a second reason is definitely more tangible for people who are understanding the role of language in development. And it is that when you are able to integrate language policies that show dignity to minority languages and preserve minority languages, the result is you're going to have a happier and more coherent society which respects its heritage in a more wholesome way. And this definitely has its micro foundations in that people are happier when they're able to preserve their mother tongues. And through that, the role of language policy is really cannot be overstated in international development, both in its ability to make communities happy, but also bridge communities. And this is definitely a theme that is growing to be more important as we look at a more multicultural and multi-ethnic world. So today I have a very interesting guest with me who has written a very extensive and insightful book on the role of language preservation. And so I hope through that we can spur some conversation and perhaps in some ways change the way that we think about what international development should be about. That would be my big goal for today. And I hope that you have a fun time listening to this. It was very fun making this podcast for you. So in China, there's many dialects, and I happen to speak one of them. I was taught by my grandparents when I was young, and it's called Wenzhouhua. And what makes it so famous in China is that it is actually known to be a very alien and different and slightly archaic language, judging by how different it sounds from, you know, regional languages that we have in the district. This is so much so that if you were to go to the Wikipedia page of my dialect, I think somebody cheekily put on there that it's known as the devil's language, which sometimes makes sense. I think we have 8 or 10 different tones, and so it's almost impossible for anybody who didn't grow up speaking it to pronounce it properly. And some of the words to this day I still have trouble pronouncing as well. The thing is, my town has a lot of pride in the language, but not many people speak it anymore. And this is so much the case that when my mom and I, we went back to my hometown during the vacations, and we were just chatting in the taxi, speaking to each other in the dialect that we always do. The taxi driver looked back and directly asked whether we were from abroad. That was not because we were saying things or mispronouncing things with a Western accent, but more so because nobody our age, or at least my age, in our city speaks our dialect anymore. It is not a practical language to learn, and there is really no economic incentive for you to learn it. Not many people speak it across the country, so the incentives of putting it on your CV are basically zero. I guess the only reason why I even bring it up in conversations is just as a fun fact about myself. And apart from this, there's really no other reason for me to talk about this language to non-speakers. So it is the unavoidable fact that one day this language will inevitably die out, as there is really not another incentive for people to pick it up, should they not speak it already. To a lot of people, these are just passing clouds and they don't really matter too much. But in this podcast, I try to make the case that it does. It makes a big difference. And to see why, we must get a scope of how big this problem is, of this global change that is turning the tides against minority languages, and what is really happening to minority languages across the world.
Yeah, so at a macro level, kind of since the advent of industrialization and globalization, there has been a more or less continual denuding of the amount of languages spoken around the world. So according to kind of the most recent statistics, we've got about 7,000 odd languages spoken around the world, which obviously sounds like a lot, but half of the planet speaks one of just 23 languages. So you know, the vast majority of those 7,000 languages are minority languages. Some 2,400 of them are endangered, about 600 of them are on the verge of extinction. This is a number that just keeps growing and growing every year.
That is James Griffiths, the author of the book Speak Not: Empire, Identity, and the Politics of Language, a book which uses very fascinating case studies to document the change and impact of government policies on minority languages and its subsequent consequences on the communities around them. And more optimistically, also looks at cases of how minority language can be preserved and revived and its benefits on the communities and polities around it.
In the book, I kind of explore this topic it by looking at a number of languages. So there are three languages that are the focus of the book, which is Welsh, which is a language I grew up speaking, Hawaiian, which is probably the most vulnerable language that I talk about in the book, and Cantonese. And Cantonese is not a minority language or an endangered language by any stretch of the imagination. It's spoken by millions of people around the world. But what's very interesting about it is that it's a what can be considered a very strong language, even a you know majority language, arguably in some places, or you know certainly in Hong Kong where I live, and at the same time it's still vulnerable, and we're still seeing this dramatic transformation. It's already very much underway in Guangdong province in China, which is the language the place where the language takes its name from, and it's spoken widely. That's you know, the amount of speakers has gone down significantly. It's pretty much a kind of bilingual province with Mandarin Putonghua at this point. And that's having a major effect on the next generation. And then we're also starting to see heading in that direction in Hong Kong. So what I found very interesting was to look at these three languages, a number of other languages at various stages of the kind of process of either being denuded or trying to have a revival, you know, trying to come back from the brink in some cases, and explore why languages end up in that situation, what has been done, and kind of what is being done, and also the extent to which there is now a model for language revival that can be followed by languages around the world.
Now, this is all very interesting, but I think for lots of the listeners right now who don't really speak a minority language, they might have a hard time relating to what's really happening here. In some cases, they might be able to sympathize that, okay, it's a bad thing to have your language slowly, you know, being eroded, but they might also have a hard time finding any tangible reasons for why languages should be preserved. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you speak a minority language in Welsh itself, and I guess your family also relocated to England in an environment which is not so Welsh speaking. Could you go through a bit of the, I guess, the personal impact of seeing your language becoming less and less spoken, and at the same time go through a few of the tangible reasons about why, you know, a perhaps apathetic listener should also care about the preservation of minority languages?
Yeah, so I come from a historically Welsh-speaking family, but both of my parents were born in England. My father's family, which is the Welsh side, moved to England when my great-grandfather was young, and they grew up. But then my parents moved back to Wales, and I was born there, and so grew up speaking Welsh. So it's kind of this full circle that the family went on in terms of coming back to speaking Welsh. And I grew up in a very Welsh community, but one that is pretty much bilingual. I mean, there aren't really monolingual Welsh communities in Wales. That hasn't been the case for decades now. And the kind of environment that I grew up in was one where there was a lot of concern around the Welsh language, that this was felt that it was kind of heading towards extinction, and there were very good reasons to believe this, and from kind of census statistics and the amount of people speaking it. And that kind of was often in a somewhat defeatist tone, and a kind of sad that this would be lost, and certainly that had been the attitude of the previous generations, that this was kind of something inevitable, and that this wasn't a kind of decline that you could stop. And that changed around my kind of generation, which we can talk about later. But what, you know, the damage that does to kind of have a really core part of your identity, a language is kind of one of the most core parts of an identity you can have, really, because it's, you know, it's the way we think, it's the way we can relate to the world, it's, you know, informs culture and everything like that. That can have a really negative effect on you know, people's mental health, on their confidence in operating. There is a lot of research done, kind of particularly in Australia and Canada. There's a lot of work been done with Indigenous communities that have been showing that communities that have retained their language and still, you know, have first language education, and children are able to grow up speaking an Indigenous language, they have better educational, better health, better economic outcomes. And then the opposite is also true, that communities that have lost their languages, often as a result of colonialism and repression, they have much worse outcomes, higher rates of depression, higher rates of alcoholism, things like that. And so you know, this has a real tangible effect on communities to lose languages and to be cut off from languages. And then there is also, you know, a really strong kind of cultural argument to be made to preserve languages and retain it, because this is how we can connect to the culture of these peoples that existed before us, and you know, kind of connect to different ideas, to different stories, different forms of arts. You know, that this is a real, you know, if you believe in multiculturalism, this is a really important part of that, you know, multiculturalism can't really exist within a monolingual context. That's just kind of shades of one culture. It's not going to, you know, it might blend in certain ways, but we need to bring in other languages, because it really does affect how you think about things and how you conceive things, and so it really does have both kind of tangible value to communities and also cultural values to the, let's say, global community, that things that can come from these languages and ideas that can come from these languages.
Yeah, that's a very insightful point. I don't know why I didn't put two and two together when I was thinking about this, but you're right. I think losing our language necessarily entails that we're losing a whole host of cultural capital that our ancestors have basically accumulated for us. And I guess if you're trying to evaluate development where it's this trade-off between economic output or losing your language, say, you know, going to the city, learning the main language and forgetting about your minority language and so on, I'm not really sure whether this trade-off means development, or at least in the sense of the cultural value that we've lost is made up for by the economic output that has increased. And No, that definitely shapes the way that we think about things. And right now, I'm just wondering why languages are going extinct in the first place.
Arguably, there would be a natural kind of degree of language decline, language slippage, just because of the way that people migrate, the way that languages change, naturally, that English changes, even though it's, the most spoken language in the world, and that some languages would kind of naturally stop being used. We don't speak Old Norse anymore. That didn't kind of go out extinct as a deliberate form of policy. It was just, it kind of, I don't like to use the term evolved, but it gradually changed in a way that it's no longer spoken, and that definitely happens. But and that sometimes is used to kind of diminish the degree to which language extinction is often a result of policy, that these languages aren't so much dying out as they're being killed, and that is, more often than not, that is the case. That certainly in the case of the languages that I look at in my book, that is definitely the case. That Welsh did not so much diminish as a result of migration from England, though that was a factor. It diminished because the British government at the time in London, and to a lesser extent, kind of local Welsh administrators, that there was an active policy of suppressing Welsh, suppressing it within the education system, encouraging families to speak English at home and just teach their children English, reducing any support for the Welsh language at an official level and a cultural level. The same happened with Hawaiian. There was a sometimes quite violent suppression of Hawaiian within the culture after American colonialism, and it's the same thing that we're seeing in China, that where there is a very, very aggressive top-down promotion of Putonghua, sometimes or often for very, noble purposes in terms of promoting communication, promoting education, but that kind of goes hand in hand with suppression of local languages and local dialects, and on often a kind of scapegoating of local languages, of portraying different non-Putonghua languages as inferior or as primitive or backwards, and it's really, really destructive, and so that's, when you see a language dying out, especially when it's a kind of minority language, it's a minority community, we can nearly always see that as a result of government policy. Maybe not active suppression in every case, but often if that's not the case, then it's in a policy of kind of official neglect, of not deigning to give these communities the support that they need, not, offering any assistance for, say, indigenous communities to promote their culture and language within the national education system or things like that. That governments are, by a long way, the main bad actors in this story.
Yeah, I think you definitely touch on a very interesting point, or I guess it's a tightrope that governments have to tread when they're trying to, I guess, introduce a common tongue, a lingua franca. And in some senses, they might have noble purposes, as you say. There are benefits to countries through deliberate policymaking to introduce a tongue that different people can speak, so that they can communicate better, they can share the resources, their knowledge. And that definitely helps economic development. But at the same time, as you point out, these kind of things can also lead to negative consequences if the government overreaches. So how do you think the government should negotiate between these two sides? Are there any benefits to lingua francas at all?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's worth distinguishing between having a lingua franca, having a predominant language or a kind of collective language that's spoken within a country, and monolingualism. A lingua franca is fundamentally a good thing. They evolved naturally all over the world. Kind of pre-globalization, there were all these kind of either really quite basic pigeons that developed between communities, struggling to communicate with each other across a variety of languages, or lingua francas that were adopted because that was the most widely spoken tongue in that area, things like that. Cantonese often became the lingua franca Chinese diaspora communities, even those not necessarily from Kanto areas, because it was maybe the majority tongue spoken by Chinese that were emigrating from China at that time. There is a key difference between that and enforcing monolingualism. So if you look at the development of Putonghua, and this is particularly interesting in this regard, because it's kind of been so deliberately developed and advanced, and it's all happened within the last, you know, 70 odd years, 100 years, that it's very interesting to look at. And the purpose of developing Putonghua, and you know, for people that aren't aware of this and don't speak a Chinese language, it is again worth distinguishing between Putonghua, the official tongue of the People's Republic of China, and Mandarin, which is a kind of older language family from which it derives. You know, it is a dialect of Mandarin, but it's distinct, and it was, you know, manufactured in a way to be easier to learn and to serve the purpose of a lingua franca. And that was done, you know, with very, very noble purposes. You know, that this was, I think I'd argue a wholly, you know, good project. But it's very interesting that if you read the early writings of people who are advancing Putonghua and calling for a national language, especially communist writers and kind of the people who developed the language, people who came to this from left-wing sides prior to the end of the Chinese Civil War, that there was a big awareness of the danger of promoting Putonghua or promoting a national language, the danger that could have for other languages. And there was a real desire to not have it be this hegemonic tongue, to have it just be a kind of backup language that everyone could revert to, that if I'm at home in Guangdong province, I'll just continue speaking Cantonese or continue speaking whatever my local language is to everyone. But if I need to go to another part of China, we'll all have Putonghua to speak. And that won't be our first language. It probably won't be the first language of most of the country, apart from certain Mandarin areas where it's pretty close. And so they might naturally switch to that, but it will be a language that we can all speak if we need to speak it. And that was, you know, again, a very noble idea. And what's unfortunate is that once the PRC was established, there was a big shift away from that towards having Putonghua as the only language that the country spoke, and really pushing that. And one of the reasons for that was there was a fear that kind of promoting or tolerating a lot of languages around the country would result in disunity, that the Communist Party was worried about holding the country together in the wake of the war, in the wake of Japanese colonialism. And there was a fear that if they didn't promote this language as a way of tying everyone together, that might lead to a kind of breaking up of the country. And we've seen other national languages and national lingua francas being pushed for the same reason. And that often results in a kind of paranoid, very aggressive advancing of those languages, where, you know, just the simple matter of speaking a different one can be seen as suspicious or as, you know, supporting separatism, which is what we've seen in lots of parts of China.
Yeah. So could you go a bit more into these cases where the government might have potentially started with a good intention at heart, but slowly use it as a way to kind of gain control over other communities as well? Because I think the case of Wales that you mentioned in the book was definitely a really pertinent example in this.
Mm. Yeah. So Wales is you know, historically is a colony of England. You know, there isn't, you know, this really, really historic. So if you go back a long, long way, the Welsh people are, you know, the ancient Britons who populated the island of Britain prior to the Anglo-Saxon invasion and migration, and so, you know, that the two communities do come from very different historical backgrounds, but you know we shouldn't kind of overemphasize the kind of racial difference, because they are essentially the same people at this point. So in the kind of late 19th century, there was a lot of unrest in Wales. There was a lot of industrial action, a lot of protests and strikes and resistance to the Industrial Revolution, which was kicking off at the time and often was very English controlled but fueled by Welsh workers. So you know, in the coal mines, in the slate mines, and various other industries around Wales. And there was a kind of desire from London to address this, and one of the kind of reasons that it was decided that the Welsh were rebelling in this way and the Welsh were unhappy was not so much due to, you know, shocking working conditions during the Victorian era or exploitation, but was down to two things, one of which was language and the other was religion. So Wales was a nonconformist lots of Protestant offshoots, Baptists and Methodists and things like that, when compared to the Anglican rest of the country. And so there was a desire to change that. There was a big push to make sure that children only grew up speaking English. We had things with this thing in lots of schools called a Welsh knot, whereby children that were found speaking Welsh had to wear a sign around their necks, and that if they were the one, and that if another child was heard speaking Welsh, the sign would get passed on, and that the kid at the end of the day that was wearing the sign would get caned, and an active, you know, suppression of the language. Parents were even told not to speak Welsh to their children at home. Were admonished by schools if they felt they weren't doing enough to promote English. You know, so it was a very, you know, active suppression of the language for essentially an economic purpose, that this was seen as something that would breed better workers, that this would breed a more pliable population, and perhaps a more Anglo population, in the sense that this was a population that wouldn't necessarily identify as separate to the rest of the British, kind of the British Empire, that this would be a population that was, you know, saw itself as, you know, English essentially.
Yeah, so could you walk us through a bit about the consequences of this kind of policy? Were there any benefits at all, and where were the costs to this being installed?
I think it's difficult to pass out the kind of benefits. Obviously, this Wales was one of the drivers of the Industrial Revolution for a long time due to the amount of coal that was being produced there and things like that. You know, there were tangible economic benefits to you know, London's policy at the time, let's say, but you know, it's very difficult to pass that out from you know, could this have happened without the language policy? I think I would argue that it definitely could have, and that I don't think we should necessarily connect development during that time to the suppression of Welsh. But what we can definitely see is the negative side of that is like I said earlier, is the damage this did to communities. We saw Wales dip from being a majority Welsh-speaking country in the 19th century to around the start of the 20th century. It becomes a minority language for the first time, and it continued to decline throughout the 20th century. And you know, this is a language that had been spoken, you know, for hundreds, if not thousands of years in this part of the world, and that this was on the rapid path to extinction as a result of an active government policy, which was, you know, some people involved in it saw this as a kind of altruistic and you know, positive thing of you know, helping people speak English and promoting the national British language. But a lot of them saw it as you know, getting rid of a you know, supposedly inferior language, and that their motivation for doing so was to create a more pliable population and to, you know, essentially to breed better workers.
Now, to some listeners, this might feel a bit too abstract and feel like, okay, we're talking about the right things, but to what extent is it really applicable? Could you give us a few examples of, say, lingua francas and minority languages both being preserved in a good way?
Yeah, there are a number of countries that you know, I think especially for people in the English speaking world, and you know, and probably in a number of other you know, monolingual countries, you know, or you know, sorry, let me start again. I think for people in the English speaking world, especially people who are monolingual within that, because obviously there are a number of, you know, there's a huge number of people within Anglo countries that you know aren't monolingual and speak other languages than English. But it's often quite easy to forget or just not realize that this is not a model that exists in lots of parts of the world, that lots of countries are, you know, officially bilingual or officially multilingual and, you know, thrive as, you know, with that model. You know, India is the sixth largest economy in the world. It has 22 official languages. It has more than 100 languages in practice. You know, it functions as a country and it functions as an economy. You know, I don't want to say despite that because I don't think it's necessarily a hurdle. You know, arguably it functions maybe because of that. You know, Indonesia again, which is, you know, the 16th largest economy, that has over a dozen languages with a million speakers. You know, there are these huge countries that have huge linguistic diversity and continue to succeed. Canada, which probably, you know, is often maybe thought of as an English speaking country, is officially bilingual. You know, it has done a huge amount to support the French speaking community in Canada at an official level. French speaking parts of the country are, you know, Quebec is primary French, and, you know, other parts of the country are, you know, have a lot of support for French speakers. That's not to say that Canada has got everything right. There is a lot of criticism to make of Canada's support for Indigenous languages and the ongoing suppression of Indigenous culture. But again, there is a model that works, and it's everywhere in the world. You know, to give one more example, Nigeria, which is the largest economy in Africa, that has multiple languages with tens of millions of speakers. You know, this idea that countries need to be monolingual to be successful, or even that they need to have a really dominant language to be successful, is just not the case. And I think all of these countries, to go back to my earlier point, they show the success you can have with a lingua franca versus promoting monolingualism. You know, obviously these countries have shared languages that people speak within them, but they don't, as you know, they don't kind of take that next step from having a shared language and promoting a shared language to suppressing other languages.
Yeah, listening to all these, you know, promising examples definitely makes me feel a bit more optimistic about things, because I think a big challenge to the developing world is trying to find a way to bond somewhat ethnically heterogeneous populations together, and that has been a big cause of tension among different groups, different interest groups, and a big bottleneck for economic integration of post-colonial nations as well. So I guess, you know, drawing lessons from cases where lingua francas were used in a way that did not further stoke ethnic tensions is definitely very promising. And I guess it is a policy that lots of policymakers should bear in mind when they are looking for ways to address the fractionalization of the nation. So, you know, I think for a lot of listeners, this might be something that a very promising answer has come from a very surprising place. You know, no one was really expecting to find a way to tackle ethnic fractionalization, at least in my opinion, from the angle of language. But it is really crucial. It is the basis of human relationship. So, yes, I'm just very, very excited by this piece of information that I've just received. And I think for a lot of us, this definitely increases the toolset that we have when we're analyzing questions regarding ethnic fractionalization and seeing how we can really address it in a way that is fundamental and respects our cultural differences as well. There is something that is still on my mind, and that is, you know, on one hand, we found ways to try to preserve both a lingua franca and also the minority languages. But what happens to minority languages who are already so much in decline that they need revival? What is really a good way to revive languages so that it's not just stylistic, but also actually makes a substantive change to society? at large as well.
One of the things that really interested me in doing the initial research for the book was the fact that Welsh is actually a model for a number of language communities around the world. That, you know, this, we are a tiny country of about 3 million people with less than 1 million Welsh speakers. You know, Wales is not typically a model for anything internationally, and so it was, you know, it was very interesting to find this. And the reason that is because the Welsh language revival has been successful, and that the model that was developed for that and that has been developed in a number of other countries and increasingly now is being developed, you know, globally and together, and that people are sharing research and sharing advice and sharing models, is very effective. It's been proven dozens and dozens of times with various languages, and it, you know, primarily focuses on education. It's very, very important that children are given a chance to learn in a language that from the earliest age, so from kind of kindergarten age upwards. And then it's also very important that there is support for culture, because otherwise you get something where people speak a language in school, but they don't necessarily take it beyond that. That a language becomes somewhat fossilized, and it doesn't really enter that living language stage or maintain that living language stage where it continues to develop and to kind of modernize. And I think that was true to a certain extent in Wales for a while, and I use this term English first bilingualism in the book, and you know, it's a term been used by other people as well, that Wales still has a long way to go, in that while there has been a generation or two generations now who've grown up speaking Welsh and learning Welsh in school, that English is still very much the primary language of the country, and that often it is the only language that's spoken in certain spheres, that you know, even children or even people who use Welsh maybe as their primary language, they might still switch to using English in certain areas. They might be using English within the workplace, or they might only use English when they're you know operating online, things like that, you know. So that there are a lot of challenges and there are a lot of areas to do this, and the kind of most important thing is just in the way that the government suppression is the primary driver of language decline. This, you know, there is, I, you know, there is not really a successful model of language revival without some level of government support and government intervention, just because this is a very, very large project, and it requires a degree of resources that is often very difficult to manage at a private level or at a community level. Not to say that there isn't important work that can be done, but if we're talking about genuine revival, then you really do need government buy-in for it.
Yeah, no, that's actually really interesting, because I think I read something about, I think it was bilingual schools in Xinjiang in China, and where despite there was this opportunity for children to attend school at this bilingual school, it was there were two problems. One was that these bilingual schools were in rather impoverished areas, so that means that the schools were grossly underfunded, and so anybody who went there will be disadvantaged for the Gaokao system compared to people who'd say would go to the main cities in Xinjiang. But the other problem was that despite there being a chance for people to learn these, to learn at these bilingual schools, society at large was still had no use for the Uyghur language. And so for them, even if they went to learn it, after they say these people, these graduates, they'll go to say Beijing or somewhere else for university and they'll come back, it would have gotten slightly rusty as well. So do you think, apart from, say, government intervention, does there also need to be some kind of cultural appreciation throughout society for this kind of, I guess, these spaces outside of Welsh-speaking or, dialect-speaking areas as well?
Yeah, I think there needs to be an active effort to create a language that is being used and is being spoken, you know, throughout the country or throughout the community. You know, we're speaking in terms of countries in the Welsh context, but you know, often it's not necessarily at a country level. You know, if you look at somewhere like Australia or Canada, you know, there are much smaller geographic areas where you could have an indigenous language being spoken. And what's very important is for there to be a space to use the language, like you said, that even if, you know, even if you learn a language, and people are probably very familiar with this, not from a minority language perspective, but just from a you know, language learner perspective, that I'm sure that anyone that's learned, you know, even some of a language realizes how hard it is to maintain that language if you're not using it regularly and you can't communicate in it with people, that you know you can do a lot with reading and with playing on apps and stuff, but you're not gonna be a fluent speaker and you're not gonna be a daily speaker if you can't use it in real life. And so it is very important to create these spaces, and not just at a kind of level where people are speaking it as a kind of, you know, extra education, you know, not kind of after school things or continuing education. You know, it needs to be a genuine use of the language, and so, you know, that's really where culture comes in. You know, if you can have if you can have plays in the language, you can have books written in the language, if you know, there is support for performances and music and you know, live culture within it, that creates a space to engage with it and then also to discuss it afterwards. And you know, it as I'm sure listeners are thinking, you know, this is obviously something that is very difficult and it takes a lot of work, but there are models for it and it has been successful, and even small things do make a difference. So there has been, we can show a tangible difference in say Wales again, that adding Welsh to even just to street signs, which was a big push in the 70s and 80s, that had a tangible benefit because it made the language visible, you know, all over the country. The fact that you couldn't walk anywhere without seeing the language, that helped raise its cachet within the community and helped make the generation of speakers more confident in using it, and then fed into people's desire to learn the language as you know, English, well, as Anglo-Welsh people or as immigrants from outside. You know, even small things like that can have a real difference and can kind of snowball in creating this space to use it in future.
Yeah, as you were speaking that all of this, one example that definitely spurred to my mind was the case of New Zealand, where, you know, although things are not perfect, I think the dispersion of language throughout society has really just caught on and has led to this wide cultural appreciation of Maori culture that was initiated by the language spreading throughout society, but definitely has continued and carried on beyond language. What do you take of the New Zealand experience yourself?
Yeah, I think the example of New Zealand is fascinating because I have not researched New Zealand in detail, so I don't want to kind of be too complimentary, because I'm sure there's a lot of problems with the New Zealand government again as a post-colonial society and how it deals with the Maori community. But the way that Maori is developing, especially within the younger generations of both Te Ora Māori speakers and non-Māori communities is fascinating, that you have people who are from, you know, completely Anglo or other non-Māori backgrounds, like you said, using Māori words frequently, actively learning Māori. Just recently we saw Lord, you know, the New Zealand pop star, she translated her most recent she worked with a number of Maori musicians and Maori language activists to bring out a version of her latest album in Te Ora Maori. And, you know, that has a huge effect for kids growing up, both Maori kids who might, you know, in a previous generation have not thought their language was you know, something that modern culture was being created in and was something that had that real value and cachet to it. And for you know, Anglo kids who might previously not have learned it, or you know, might have resented learning it in school and not thought it was something they could use regularly. You know, I think New Zealand is really modeling a really interesting example of a post-colonial society where you still have it's still definitely a minority language, but it is being promoted in a way that you could see it becoming a truly bilingual society in future. And so I think that's really, really interesting. And it shows that you can have a government, you know, step in and help, you know, step in and promote this in a way that really benefits everyone. And like you said, in a way that actually ties the community together more, it ties New Zealand, it gives New Zealand more of a distinct identity, that it's, you know, that it's not just another former British colony. It is, you know, Aotearoa, that it has its own distinct identity, even if you come from a settler background.
Yeah, no, I think definitely, I'm not an expert in the post-colonial treatment of Maori in New Zealand, but you know, just abstracting from the case, I guess it comes to show that the appreciation of language has massive positive spillover effects into how cultural appreciation and in some senses cultural harmony can be cultivated by language itself, which I guess in many ways that you've emphasized, language is this fundamental expression of culture. And being able to speak to another person in the same language that they also speak is something that is truly powerful and whose, you know, emotional effects are not restricted to just the interpersonal relationship, but also the cultural facet, which in many ways makes life more fulfilling. So, yeah, I think it's definitely one of the facets of development, of at least development as what it means to live a good life, which has been overlooked, but shouldn't really be overlooked any longer. Now, it's definitely been a wonderful time learning about the role that language has, both tangibly on connecting different economies and different markets together, but to me, at least, more importantly, culturally, on its role of cultural enrichment, of cultural, multicultural, cultural appreciation, and trying to bridge the gap and, you know, the borders between different ethnicities and different countries, which, in my opinion, should be the goal of development. It's also been a big, big pleasure and honor to have James here with us again. For those of you who have heard the other podcasts from Oxid, James' voice might be familiar, and that's because it is the second time that James has been on an Oxid podcast. And so we thank him again for taking his time to be here with us, and his book on languages and the politics of languages, Speak Not, is releasing this October. So if you're interested, please make sure to check your bookstores. Once again, it's been a pleasure to be your host for this podcast. I hope that the goal of this podcast, which was to in some ways nudge you towards an appreciation of the role of language in development, has been achieved. And you know, it's always been a lot of fun making these podcasts, and I look forward to seeing you again later in term with more podcasts to come. Thank you very much, and it's been a pleasure.